noticed that I am not Andreas, and of course the director of the Centre for Research in Freemasonry and Fraternalism. Unfortunately, Andreas is unable to be here today, so I've taken his place. My name is David Shepherd. I'm director of the Humanities Research Institute, which is the institutional and the, of course, physical home of the CRFF. I'm very pleased to welcome you to this afternoon's seminar. This is the second in the 2008 lecture series of the CRFF, and it's a great pleasure for me to introduce our speaker today, who is Dorothee Sommer of the University of Sheffield. Dorothee actually works here as a research support coordinator in the CRFF, but she also has responsibilities in relation to the HRI overall. She's also at the same time studying for her PhD here at the University of Sheffield, a degree that she intends to add to an already impressive list of qualifications. She did her first degree in general rhetoric and political science in Tübingen in Germany, which is where she's from. And she also has an MA from Tel Aviv University in history of the Middle East, receiving her MA magna cum laude on the dissertation on Scottish lodges in Greater Syria during the time of the Ottoman Empire. And her research now focuses on European lodges in the same area in general, concentrating on national and transnational interdependence, social, political and economic. She's going to talk to us today about the first Masonic lodges in Ottoman Syria. Thank you very much.
Thank you.
I'm out of the way of the screen.
I will stand. I feel better, I think. So thank you for coming to our new series of lectures. It's a kind of experiment with these subjects, and well, we hope we can make our audience a bit bigger and bigger with every next series. And yeah, so my subject of the lecture is today not the lodges in Tripoli, but the first ones in Greater Syria, which were in Beirut, the capital. And I want to talk about the purpose of the first lodges that were founded. Since they were naturally in Beirut, I focus on them and make some comparison to other lodges, but try to be strict. And if I take too much time, just make a sign or whatever. I'm not used to speak for that long. I want to show that although the lodges attracted all these kind of intelligent and reform-minded men, that was not their real raison d'être. Instead, it was less complicated. The main reason was to keep the whole society at peace. And it was not as often emphasized by European researchers, the European grand bodies like the Grand Lodge of Scotland or the Grand Royal de France that established the lodges and controlled them. But more, it was the Lebanese Masons that cleverly exploited this European concept of masonry, using the competition between the European powers at that time active in the Ottoman Empire, which was mainly France and England. Because most of us don't know exactly where the Ottoman Empire was. I have here a card, and you can see all the losses of territory in really such a short period of time, mainly at the beginning of the 18th century and 19th century, and then throughout the 19th century until finally the resolvement of the whole empire, and Turkey was left. So when this was also the time when the Ottoman Empire was called the sick man of Europe, and all countries, you see, it lost. Plus later in 1912, there was also Libya, it lost to Italy. Besides that, it had incredible deprivations financially wise. Its foreign debts were growing and growing with France and with England. And that's why they had the Sultan had to give France and Britain a lot of concessions, which means by the name capitulations. So that means that they had to pay less taxes, they had easier trade, the whole trade was easier for them. All subjects, foreign subjects in the Ottoman Empire were not subject to Ottoman law, they were subject to European law. And also the Ottomans working for England or France, be as a translator in the consulate or as representative of a consul in Tripoli or whatever, they were automatically foreign subjects and also subject to foreign law, which many of them, of course, used because that how they could escape their own law and the Sharia. Then other financial loss came because of the infrastructure. Not only the weapons had to be bought for the wars, but also the infrastructure had to be improved for the trade, which was, on the one side, it was good for the inhabitants too. I mean, it was helpful for their own trade, but more all the infrastructure was again under the supervision of the Europeans, mainly France. And again, it, of course, served also the Europeans just to intervene more and more into the empire. At this time, not only that all the politicians were gathered in a way in Beirut. Beirut was really kind of, it was called the Little Paris. Well, it's a bit exaggerated. But all the Europeans are really there clustered, politicians, missionaries, the heads of the churches, mainly the Orthodox churches, were in Beirut. The important government bodies of the Ottoman Empire. So when we see Beirut, it's much more like the like a world city. It's a capital which you could at this time almost set in different countries. It was not a typical Ottoman sphere. This is a part of a map. It was made by Henry Jessup, who's not our Henry Jessup, but an American. He did that in 1873, and he was a missionary of the American Presbyterian Church. And here is the red ones are the Presbyterians, the Americans. The yellow ones are the green ones are the Free Church of Scotland. And the yellow ones, yeah, are the British Syrian female schools. And then you have some crosses, which are the Greek and Roman monasteries. At this time, Jessup estimates, I think it's too much what he thinks, but he says at this time there are around 2 million people living in Beirut, from which 1 million are Muslims, the others are mainly Christians, and then you have about 100 Druzes and 100,000 Druzes and 30,000 Jews. So these missionaries that came, the European ones, they arrived already at the beginning of the 19th century, but only during the second half they really tried to convert more people and had also more success, although they did not succeed to convert Muslims. They were more concentrated on the Christians, which they perceived not to be the real Christians. So they had to learn how to be a real Christian, according to the missionaries. And then the problem was that although they did have success converting people, that was most opportunistic converting. I read today a sentence, the faith lasts as long as you go to their school or something like that. So actually you use their education, and why shouldn't you? And you have some kinds of profit also regard to your family, and when someone dies, how the missionaries look for the ones who stay there and who remain back. But if you leave the school, so maybe you've been at the missionary school of Protestants and then you get a job as in a Catholic school, that's fine. It's just like, how do you get your money and how do you survive, not how to keep your faith. And there's an example when Amin Maalouf says about his grandfather. He studied wherever he could study, taught, he was offered wherever he was offered a position, believed this was both his right and his duty. As for the ministers and priests, they were free to pursue their own objectives in their parishes or as missionaries. And I met another one, a relative of a Mason I was looking at, and he said, yeah, you know, and he was Muslim. And he said, yeah, you know, the Abdul Wahhabs, if it was okay, then we were Catholics or Protestants. And in fact, he was Muslim. And it was not that they didn't believe. They did believe. They had a strong traditional belief. But this was more superficial changes. So in 1873, the American Presbyterians had then the Syrian Protestant College opened. It's an old postcard from something the beginning of the 19th century. It was called later in the 1920s, it was called American University of Beirut, AUB, which still exists now and is pretty prestigious, and was already then, it was the first good school and higher school in the Ottoman Empire or in Beirut, in Greater Syria. And shortly afterwards, the French reacted and formed the Jesuit school, which was outside of Beirut, moved to Beirut, and received then the title of university in 1875, which was then the Saint Joseph University, which also still is existent and very big and prestigious. This one added then also over the years medicine, pharmacy, Oriental studies, and French law. At the same time, you had also reforms of the Ottoman schools, so it's also not right to say you had on the one side the traditional schools and on the other side the modern missionary schools. It was more mixed and it was never that opposite to opposite. They traditional, so-called traditional Ottoman schools also taught then after a while modern languages, sciences, and not Protestantism, of course, but they were not traditional in the sense of backward. But before these schools, or these schools had actually a kind of indirect trigger, in 1860s were a lot of fights and struggles in whole Greater Syria, mainly on the mountain and in Damascus. So on the mountain you had true, it was mostly about land, although people say it was religion, but it was mainly about land. In the mountain, you had truces against Syrian, against Sunnis, and truces against Sunnis and Maronites, mainly truces against Maronites. Maronites is another sect of Catholic faith. And you had in Damascus the Muslims against Christians. But this was mainly a consequence of the privileges the Christians enjoyed because they were working for foreigners and had more trade with them and had some had not to go to the army. Instead, they paid the jizya, and they had which is a tax, an extra tax. So they had a different status. Non-Muslims were called dhimmi, which is al-dhimma, which is the people who are protected by their leader, under the protection of, in that case, the Ottoman leader. And for that protection, they had to give this jizya, the extra tax. But in fact, practically, it was like a kind of they liberating themselves from going to the army, which the Ottomans didn't want them anyway to join, and instead paid the tax. But this brought out this status as dhimmi brought also with them that they were not allowed to exercise all professions. They were not allowed for certain wear certain clothes, live in certain areas of town. As it was not just a positive thing; it was more negative than positive. But only in the really when it came heart to heart at the end of the Ottoman Empire, Jews were the only minority who were then involved in the Ottoman army, and not except of them, it were just Muslims. So the struggles that broke out then in the 60s were mainly this kind of unequal relation between, one said, Druze Maronites over land and privileges between Muslims and Christians in Damascus. Consequences were, okay, this was one reaction, founding more educational institutions, because the belief was very strong at that time that through education, through knowledge, we can show them that they can live with each other more tolerant, they don't have to fight each other. And on the other side, you had also large migrations, so people, Maronites mainly, coming from the mountain, moving to Beirut, other people moving out of Beirut, and it was a kind of steady dynamic between all these people and former Beirutis, traditional families. They had really a time that they couldn't see all these mountainous anymore because they were everywhere in the city and kind of stormed Beirut at a time where they had hygienic problems. They had all the Europeans there. Then at 1875 you had cholera, and it was pretty chaotic then. So the population in itself, the whole, was exhausted by these inner struggles. Then the other territory they lost, we've seen at the beginning. And also they saw that their own leaders are getting weaker and weaker and having less and less defense of means of defense towards the Europeans, who are just taking their land, their trade, and everything they can, their money. So you had this situation. At the same time, you had these modernizing changes. You had a better infrastructure. Suddenly you have railway. They didn't have railway before. Then you've got the telegraph. The whole system changed with the telegraph. Of course, you the print started, and the media. And the people are still moving. The territories were the lost, which were lost. Muslims were moving into the Ottoman Empire. Christians were leaving the Ottoman Empire. I think this is actually this insecure future, this insecure situation, and this chaos was the main reason for, or the kind of midwife for, the first lodges established in Beirut. There were already before lodges, but not much is left. They were also not long existing. They were in somewhere in Egypt. Contact to them was where, because I mean the infrastructure wasn't there yet. And some had been in what's today Turkey. But the first lodge, which is also documented in Beirut, was the Palestine Lodge, number 415. And it was established 1861 under the obedience of the Grand Lodge of Scotland. It's received its charter in a strange way. Normally it's this, you have to have at least 7 masons. They have to write a petition, send it to the concerned Grand Lodge, and this Grand Lodge, and they also have to have at least 4 people who recommend them, other masons from different lodges. So normally the Grand Lodge then decides if there's really reason to build another lodge, to establish another lodge, and gives, grants them then the charter. But this lodge was established at some Lieutenant Colonel Burnaby, commissioner of the British government to the French army of occupation, came quick to Scotland, said, here's our a petition, and please give me the charter, and I have to go back to Beirut, and is that okay? And strangely enough, he got his charter, and they started the lodge, which is good for them, but bad for us, since now we don't know who the founders were, except of this Lieutenant Burnaby. So the first lodge, Palestine, took as its color blue. Like you all, every lodge has a different color as kind of or a character or mark. And most of the first lodges in Beirut, in Greater Syria, took blue. And we think by now, although it was different blues like royal blue, navy blue, sky blue, that they mix it up. They thought, because blue is connected to the old lodge, the Grand Lodge, the first Grand Lodge in England, they probably thought, well, blue must be something regular and recognized. And so we have all the first lodges, or a lot of them were blue, also one in the mountains, Sunin, which choose first blue, then somehow they must have changed to black, and until 1929, they were the only of all the Scottish daughter lodges, which were by then about 2,000, which had black as color. So it was actually a good change. I have here one apron I saw. It is an apron I saw in Tripoli, but it's not that old. It's probably from the 50s or 60s, but they still keep it because, yeah, it must have been from another Lebanese lodge, and it's kind of remembering them. So then I had to look at what kind of people joined Palestine. And I went to the registration lists where the names are listed next to the professions. So when it started, it didn't last long. It lasted only until 1889. But it had about 150 members, all upper class elite, from mayors, most from foreign countries, some Beirutis, some from Egypt, and no religious people. Of course, they're not clergy, but more urban, prestigious families or individuals in general. So at least were one third were foreigners, Europeans as well as Arabs. Tradesmen were considered the biggest part, afterwards came the so-called intellectuals, which I mean it's like professors, teachers, students, doctors, employees for the Ottoman government, coming third. But I think these categories shouldn't be seen that strict, because at that time the men had all kind of professions. So someone could be, could be a teacher, and at the same time he was the vice consul or the representative for Scotland or for Belgium. Most of them indeed were businessmen, at the same time dragoman, translator or whatever, working for European power. But there was one distinction I would like to make between this one, the lodges in Beirut, and later ones in other cities, in smaller cities. It's most full-time intellectuals, like really men who were connected to writing, teaching, for that was their main profession, were mainly in Beirut. I mean, it's logical, it's the capital. But I think it's, so we have to look differently at different lodges, and they're also taking into relation their surrounding, their economic surrounding, their social surrounding. Also, this European flair is typical capital. You wouldn't find that in the maybe in the mountains when they go for summer vacation, but not in a, say, Damascus. So I thought I'd give some example, short ones, for members of Palestine. There was, for example, the son of Abdelkader. Abdelkader was one of the famous emirs who saved a lot of Christians during these struggles in Damascus, who opened his house for his Christians and let them all in until the Muslims were quieter again. And he was very famous just for this deed, and had all kind of Ottoman jobs, was himself also Freemason, and both of his sons were Freemasons, one in Lodge Palestine. Then there was Nassif Mishaka and Dimitri Sursok. Like the Mishaka family, they were originally a Greek Orthodox family from Corfu, and when they came, they were all kind of merchants and got richer and richer, and they had they even were not called Mishaka. They were actually, their family name was Badraki, but they changed to Mishaka because it's kind of derived from the process of making silk. And since they really entered the trade with silk, they also took on this name. And sometime they converted also from Catholicism to Protestantism. One was dragoman, the other one was representative of consul, and both dragomans who worked for the American consulate joined to some time then the Palestine Lodge. And the Sursoks I mentioned were also Greek Orthodox family, is by now I think still the richest family of, I don't know, I think so, in Beirut. This is actually their museum, still existing, was built at the beginning of the 19th century. They have a palace, they have a museum, they still have their own Sursok Street, and were simply the prestigious Christians, if there were some at this time, and the richest in their Ashrafia and quota for sure. And also they were all the time, they worked for the Europeans, some as dragoman or for the consulate, whatever. Yes, then we have another one who also worked for the Prussian consulate, his name was Catafago, and he was at the same time also member of the Syrian Society of Arts and Sciences, and that was another sign for this period of time. Suddenly all these societies were built, Syrian Society for Science, then art societies, all kind of, because of the economic heart time they had, all kinds of welfare and charity societies. And of course, then first they were mainly Christians, then the Muslims had also to do something, to establish something, because most of these associations were according to sectarian lines. So they helped mostly the Christians, and the Muslims had to build their own society. So they established the Muslim Benevolent Society, and one of the founders was Hassan Bayhum, and he's again another member of the Palestine Lodge. and the Bayoum family in general is one of the rare Muslim families that really worked together with Europeans and succeeded in getting some hold in this whole kind of by now global trade. And they also had from 1868 to 1908 always someone from their family in the municipality of Beirut. Another sign, all these elite families had someone all the time somehow connected to these societies, to some European government, and then somehow in the municipality. And it was kind of dynastic almost, that someone from the Bayoum family does this year, so the next year maybe his younger brother. Then we have, of course, someone connected to the Syrian Protestant College, which was a Maronite, Elias Habilin, which is strange because the Maronites were actually the ones most strongly against Masons. The Maronite Patriarchate was really excommunicating all the members of the church he knew were joining the Masonry. For them, it was, first of all, it was against religion. That's for sure. Masons, there must be something wrong if they have to work in secret. Then both of them were minorities, the Maronites as well as us, the Masons. So they were fighting actually among the same audience and tried to get the same people to their church. And the Maronite church at this point of stage had a problem since with all these reforms, all the old traditional important ulama or clergy actually lost importance because new professions started to exist and were established, like with the silk traders, translators, and they really gained more and more hand of the upper class. Another sign was their involvement of the Masons' involvement in newspapers. I think it's just like one certain kind of mindset, the belief in education and in knowledge. And newspapers was one way, it was cheaper than books, not everyone could print books. And a lot of them had, after a certain time, private printing machines. So they gave out a lot of newspapers, journals, periodicals. Funny thing is that most of them, or a lot of them, have names of lodges. So I don't know if it's just accidentally, like Le Liban is a lodge, Al-Art was a newspaper at the same time, it was a lodge, the Cedars translated. La Taif was a lodge, and at the same time newspaper of Shahin Makarios was actually traveling through all the lodges. Anyway, and I could go on. Druzes, the biggest Druze family from Mount Lebanon, was the Jumblatt family, the most prestigious Palestine members. Colonel Henry Churchill, member of Syrian Scientific Society, like the Bayoums, also Palestine members. And it's kind of, you've got this, this same kind of people joining this lodge and trying to make something out of it, which is very far away from the normal people, the average people, because it's just too, it's like in a capital, the intelligentsia, where they just the gap between the ones who normally living there, workers, to the upper elite, to the ones who can also pay for Masons, is just huge. The difference between these lodges and these associations were mainly that they were not accorded sectarian lines, the lodges, but the most of the societies and the successful and for over a longer period societies, they were along sectarian lines. And the main difference between the lodges in Beirut and its surrounding is that, as I said, in Beirut you have the big shots, you have the big families, the prestigious families, but also the individuals like the Sursoks, the Dimitri Sursok, Bustanis, Boutros al-Bustani, even the individuals, they're still kept in mind today. They have a role, they have translated mainly. Some have helped to translate the Bible in Arabic, some have translated Robin Hood. So they are still remembered so-called Arab intellectuals with free thoughts, and you won't find that in, not at least not that many, in Tripoli, in Damascus. Yeah, that Abdul Wahab was saying when his grandfather, they had housemates, and every time when they put some makeup on, the father asked them, are you making yourself beautiful for the Chuleibs? Because the Chuleibs was another huge family, and very, like, maybe we would say Rockefeller, for the Rockefellers. So everyone knew what's meant with this example. And there was just the last foreigner I want to mention. It's this one. He made a beautiful map of Beirut. His name was Julius Leutert, Vice Consul of Denmark. The map he made in 1876. And he was also a member of Palestine. And not only that, I mean, I think he collected titles, because he was Knight of the Danish Order of Dannebrog, Officier d'Académie in France, Knight of the Swedish Order of the Polar Star, and decorated with the third class of the Turkish Order of Mecidiye. So, I don't know, maybe it was just the title he wanted to get, that's why he wanted to be member of Palestine, it can be. In general, there were so many different nationalities that someone describes the meeting of the Palestine Lodge as Babylonian confusion, with a worshipful master being a Greek, the senior warden, an Englishman, the junior warden, a Frenchman, German nationalities being represented by three Germans and one Swiss, and the secretary of the lodge is an Italian. So not really typical Arab lodge, I would say. So if the aim of this lodge was really to keep away the influence of the Europeans and to protect its participants, mainly the Arab or the Greater Syrians, probably it was not really successful with that. On the other hand, just the fact that so many members from the upper class joined gave it such a kind of relevance. Moreover, although there was then dormant and had to close a few times because the Ottoman Empire tried to just to close all lodges or just to drive out all the Masons. Even when it still existed, some of them left and founded already the next one. So some reason must there have been. If not, they would probably just have said, okay, it doesn't work, we leave it up. So in 1882, Palestine really had problems and sent a letter to the Grand Lodge of Scotland. And they asked for counsel in circumstances of difficulty, in which Freemasons have been placed through recent political changes in Syria. So this was 1882, but I think it's before that already, when Abdulhamid II rises to power, which is in 1876, he abrogated the parliament together with the constitution and started really with his oppressive and pervasive methods to eliminate lodges throughout the empire. And during his reign, all the afterwards coming lodges, they always had certain times when they were just dormant, because it was just too dangerous to meet. It was not like in Saloniki where someone wrote after the Young Turk Revolution, they were all fighting, jubilating on the streets. They didn't think, they didn't trust the situation even after the Young Turk Revolution, because they were just too afraid that something happens. Although one must say, when one asks now Syrians to describe the Ottoman rule, they see it as in a much more negative light than it actually was. I mean, there were also good things. There were modernization, there were another educational system, there were infrastructure. Abdulhamid tried to kind of reform political structures and to decentralize the government for a time being at least, and it didn't work out. It was only half-hearted, that's true. But it was not 100% black, white, and bad and good. So as I said, it was much easier for the Christians to adapt to these Europeans and also to learn different languages, just to go to a Christian school and learn different languages. They were the first ones. So when people moved, left the country, especially after 1860, most of the Christians, most of them, Muslims and Christians, left either for Egypt, just Brazil. Strange enough, they call themselves the real Brazilians, and to America, main America, where they had after a while certain settlements where mainly Lebanese people were living. The problem with the statistics here is that Christians who were leaving, no, begin first. Muslims who were leaving knew, of course, that for Christians it's much easier to get along in America because they are Christians too, so they accept them much easier than Muslims, the strange barbarian Muslims. So most of the Muslims started in a boat as Muslims, but ended in America as Christians with Christian names. So you don't know when you read the name if that's a pseudo-Christian or a Muslim. But most of the Christians, or a lot of them, knew that when Muslims come to America, they get some incentives to change, to convert. So Christians landed as Muslims just to get some money or some support. So you don't know. It's a Muslim name. But who is behind that? It's, well, yeah. So Amin Maalouf says also what I tried to say before, like a doctrine should serve the people, not the other way around. And also the Palestinian Salih Nusseibeh writes about his grandfather who had the same attitude. Religion is there for the people and not the other way around. So that was actually the essence of that. Not that they didn't believe, but some things were simply more important than staying Protestant or whatever. So for the other ones that stayed, through the improved infrastructure, it was much easier for them to travel. So this was also one reason why now lodges started to be established also not only in Beirut but outside, and that they moved really. I don't know how many know that, but if you are a Mason and you say you travel to another country and your Grand Lodge or your lodge is recognized by the other lodges, normally you can expect some Masonic hospitality. People welcome you. You are helped financially or just given some food, or they help you to find some place to stay. So I think a lot of Freemasons were Freemasons because then it was much easier to travel. And for example, they had the World Fair in 1893 in Chicago. And I checked the names of the organizers, and most of them were Masons who ended up in Chicago, and Beirutis, rich Beirutis, who supported their kind of stable they had, Abdul Hamid, and they had horses there and belly dancers, and I don't know what. But I mean, at the same time, they met other Masons in Chicago, which I couldn't prove. I thought, so well, if they are connected to the World Fair, they must have someone met there. But then I found a book from General John Corson Smith from Chicago, who traveled himself. He came from Chicago to Egypt and Lebanon. And there he meets all his friends from Chicago. He met already in Chicago at the World Fair. So, right. I left this out. This is actually very nice. It's from a travel guide from 1905, a German travel guide, which says that the over-eagerness of the Turkish censorship also sometimes reaches out to travel books. You avoid difficulties when you just put the book before you cross the border of Turkey, or before you come into a Turkish port, just put it in your pocket. And I mean, it's just a travel guide. It's nothing Masonic, but Abdul Hamid was kind of strict. So yeah, here we go. This is General John Corson Smith, who was born in Philadelphia in 1832. He was, among others, also treasurer of Illinois twice, and Illinois lieutenant governor from Illinois. That's it. So he travels to, he is in Lebanon. He has a nice party. And here he meets the Grand Master of the Egyptian Freemasons, which is at this time Idris Bey Rajib. Although I say at this time he was Grand Master for 32 or 35 years. At this travel, this Smith gets all kind of presents. He gets the honorary title of, it was written here, honorary Grand Master of Egypt. And at the same time, two newspaper articles in Egypt appear mentioning his visit and whom he met. In Egypt, it's possible to do that. It wouldn't have been possible to write something like that in Syria. So that's why also most of the printers, the journalists, went, at least for a time being, if not for good, to Egypt. And that's where I meet part of them. The others he meets then in Lebanon. So the setting up of lodges was, in general, it was until the First World War, it was really systematically spreading lodges, and it was uninterrupted except of some short periods when lodges went dormant because of the Ottoman regime of the government. It was a kind of migration from one lodge to the other, visiting one or the other lodge. And even when, as I said, Palestine was not dormant yet, another lodge was established, which was Le Liban, 1869. It was established under the Grand Orient de France. The problem was it was established before the split of the Grand Lodges. In 1877, the Grand Lodges, most of the British ones, the Grand Orient split with the others. Normally, as Mason, you have to make an oath on the Grand Architect, on the Supreme Being. And the Grand Orient de France, at this time, at the end of the 19th century, you had an anti-clerical mood without an end in France. So they say, no, we also want the atheists and the non-believers and the ones who doubt in our lodges, so we don't need this oath. But this, at the same time, rendered the British Grand Bodies to say, okay, and we don't recognize you anymore. So this split happened in 1877, and of course, the daughter lodges were concerned too. Now, the Liban is founded 8 years before under the Grand Orient de France, and then the split happens. Now they got trouble. So every time they now want to go, at this time it was also the Chicago, they made the example, they send a letter to the Grand Orient, please help us, what should we do? I mean, we're not recognized anymore by British lodges in Chicago. So most what they did is they were members of both. So why not? Actually, it shouldn't be possible. You're not allowed as member of a British Grand, belong to the British Grand Lodge, you're not allowed to be an active French Mason. But at this time, well, I think it wasn't taken that serious, which was good for the Ottoman Empire, but it was taken serious out of the Ottoman Empire, so traveling wasn't easier with that. And I also think that the Grand Lodges at this time didn't take it that serious, because there are letters where the Grand Lodge of Scotland says to one of its members in Lebanon, yeah, you know, Brother Shuker, something's wrong with the Sunin Lodge, which was another Scottish one on the mountains, and maybe you check what's going on there, and if you need some help, take a commission, take some people with you, and they make examples. They count some other names of Masons. The problem of them is they are not all British Masons. There are a lot of them who are just Le Liban Masons. So even in the Grand Lodge of Scotland must have known that. I don't know that it didn't know it. So, but even for them, it was for political reasons. It was just opportune just to go over it and just let them be. Then England gained political power. The Suez Canal was opened also in 1869. So maybe the Masons thought that would be another chance to open another lodge. But again, we stick to the Scots now. Although they were very close to France, because France had actually since the 18th century, they had kind of capitulations and took over the protection of the Maronites. Even the Maronites in letters called themselves Petit Français. Still, they opened the next lodge under the Grand Lodge of Scotland. Again, they didn't have so much support from France. So when the Peace Lodge opened, it was again under Scotland. But Le Liban grew really fast. And it had already after 1 year, they established another French lodge, because some of the Liban said, it's too big. All these translation always all the time from French to Arabic, and you take in everyone who's coming. You don't choose who's elected, who not. So we make our own lodge. They founded La Jeune d'Orient, and this lodge didn't last long. I don't know if it's also because of the situation in the Ottoman Empire, the government, or if it's because they couldn't attract enough foreigners, and that's why also not enough Arab Syrians took part. I don't know. At least after 1 year, they just closed down. So at this time, until 1913, Le Liban had over 560 members, among them 219 tradesmen, 138 employees for the Ottoman government, 60 doctors, 13 pharmacists, 44 landowners, 42 intellectuals. This is written in a letter from Dimitri Sursok to the birthday of his lodge, 40 years. He writes to the Grand Lodge, to the Grand Orient de France, and wants to show how good this lodge is and how big and how famous the members, Mohammed Abdu, Ibrahim Yasji, and all kind of big names at this time. And he also speaks about the charitable activities of the lodge. So they fight all the time against fanatism and cooperate with other lodges, among others, Palestine Lodge. And they founded schools, hospitals, and they were really successful in objective terms. Although they speak of Masonic schools, which they didn't found. But I don't know if he really means Masonic schools as kind of we educate our Masons, or more like schools according to Masonic ideals of equality, liberty, fraternity, which they believe is completely Masonic. And also, I mean, he says 560 members. Until then, a lot of them died already. So later he continues, of these are already 292 dead. 160 were out of the country, and 53 didn't attend. So, but still, I mean, you had 56 active members, which is actually a big lodge, except especially if they're really all active. So, right, I try to be shorter. It's too long, I realize. So, okay, say we established now the Peace Lodge in 1908, and until 1908, it was established in 1900. So in 8 years later, they had almost 200 members, and again, very famous ones. Among them is also one guy who's called Ahmed Efendi al-Ashi. Here's his decree he got from Scotland. One can't read it, not really nice. So it's his fifth decree he gets. No, the Master Mason, sorry. In 1905, the sad thing is that Peace Lodge itself doesn't have anything left. No document, nothing. Everything is burned or stolen. And they know who the founders of the lodge were. They've written that down. But except of the members, the registered in Scotland, they have something like that, no old constitutions. And by accident, I found the grandniece of a former member, which is here, this Ahmed Efendi al-Ashi, and she kept some things from him. First she didn't trust me, but then she realized that that's exactly what I'm looking for, and then she showed it to me, and it's really the original things. So this is him. He was born in Tripoli in 1867 and died in 1939, and he was the boss of the police in Tripoli. Although he joined the lodge in Beirut, I don't know. Maybe it's because he was born in Beirut and then moved to Tripoli with his whole family. Sorry, maybe that's the reason, or because Peace Lodge was very prestigious, and in Tripoli he didn't have a lot of fun at this time. Strange thing is that his granny still has all letters, all kind of letters he got from a thousand of lodges who existed once during his lifetime. In Lebanon and Syria, today Lebanon, and they all say thank you. Thank you, Brother Ashi. So I'm not sure, either he was completely corrupt, or he was a really good policeman and helped indeed the people. They don't mention what he did. Thank you, brother, you were so good, and I don't know. I come to the end, I would just want to show you something. So this is what I'm struggling with and why I didn't want to talk about Tripoli today. Because I think it's just too complicated just to get the first view of it. The Masons established all different lodges under all different grand lodges. So the colors I chose, it's not according to the grand lodges. It's just to realize the differences. And here we have Le Liban. And although Palestine was first, I would say Le Liban is really the kind of mother lodge. And when Sursok writes this letter in 1913, he even mentions you know, to fight against this religious fanatism in our country, we established a lot of other lodges in under different grand bodies. He tells that the Colonel of France. And then he started to list Hilal Lodge in Beirut, Ittihad Lodge Beirut, and he has really like four or five lodges, and it's proven, I mean, he's right, because in every of these lodges you find at least one who was former Le Liban among the founders. So they founded more, and all kind of grand lodges, just to actually to involve as many different European nationalities as possible, but also, which is pretty intelligent, Lodge of Egypt, because it shows that they are feeling also, or Turkey, that they are still Ottomans, they are not just traitors, and they have for everyone what. If you speak French, go to Kadisha. If you prefer Arabic, maybe you should go to Le Misab. And it's kind of according to locations, language, maybe also affiliation to a certain government, it's all possible. And this continued actually until 1908, until the Young Turkey Revolution, when they started to get more nationalized and to establish all kind of national grand bodies, which were not recognized out of Greater Syria, most of them. But still, I mean, they attracted then, of course, the Ottomans more, especially in a time when they have to think they lose their country over the fight between France and England, and everyone tries to get a big piece as possible from the Europeans. So this is, for example, is a picture of a wall in Damascus. This was again a lodge on Scotland, and it's from Ottoman times. It's from the beginning of the 20th century, and unfortunately it's destroyed by now. But it was found by a researcher from the German Orient Institute in Beirut, and here you see some Masonic symbols. And probably this man or whatever was member of the Noual Dimashq, which was at this time a lodge under the Grand Lodge of Scotland working in Damascus. Because of this spread, Masons also could move easily. So if you had someone like Iskander Howard, was a rich Beiruti who changed his name in Alexander Howard and moved then to today Israel or Palestine, to Jaffa. And here you have his house. It's a beautiful house. It's from last year, so it's still there. Yeah, unfortunately, you can't see here this inscription because it says Salam Aleikum and Shalom Aleichem. And to show these movements, so here you have all the different Masons moving to all different lodges, and that's why I sometimes just couldn't be too confused, because it's. You find the name, you know, you saw it somewhere, so where has it been before? And so these two Antakis go to then to El Mishab, belong eventually or sometimes also to the founders. Here, George Yanni is one of the few famous Tripoli historians. He originally comes from Le Liban and goes then to Kadisha, which is then established in Tripoli. And yeah, it's just like just to show you shortly how they all move, and it's all the time a dynamics. And this is not all. I mean, it's only a fragment, but I mean, it's enough for me. But it's just to show how it works. And I didn't include lodges in today Palestine or Egypt, because they were more on their part of Turkey, and had then their own grand lodge and their own kind of philosophy, which I didn't want to include in these lodges. I don't think it fits, but I did include El Mishab and Mina Alamin, because there I can make a nice example. So Kadisha is in Tripoli, founded 1906, El Mishab, almost the same people, 1914, Mina Alamin under the Grand Lodge of Egypt, Grand National Lodge of Egypt, almost the same people, but speaking Arabic, Kadisha is French, but actually it was almost all the time the same people. So here you see the overlapping of the founders. So all these were at the same time members of different lodges. Even they were member of all the three lodges. I think it's incredible, since Tripoli by then had so much lost against Beirut. It wasn't capital anymore, the port was not important anymore, everyone was going to Beirut, and still you have this overwhelming, overlapping, and moving around. And all the time they had, especially Amina Al-Amin, had visitors from Europe. So what I wanted to show, and hopefully I didn't confuse everyone too much, is how the concept of Freemasonry was systematically used as a tool to spread the lodges as, and therefore non-confessional cooperation and sociability. The elite of the society considered it as their responsibility to repacify, or at least to keep their peace between their fellow human beings, especially after the 1860s and the events there. So, and why was Freemasonry important? I think while all the other societies really were divided according to these sectarian lines and didn't promote actually active living together, Freemasonry tried exactly this and tried it with their own people. Like the first ones, except of Beirut, the first members in Qadisha, the first members in Mina Al-Amin, were all Arabs and not Europeans, as in Beirut was the case. And while Lebanese Masons today, or in general Masons today, tend to emphasize the role of intellectual Freemasons, be it during the Arab literal reawakening, be it during the Enlightenment, I think at this time the real significance was not their great ideas. I mean, they had the ideas anyway, if they are Masons or not, although they might have recognized their own ideas in the lodges and might have improved their education and their knowledge. True, I don't say it's wrong, but I think what really was important at this time, after these struggles and violence between the people, was just to keep peace. That was sociability between the different religions. That was the main reason for all this lodge spreading. And that's actually what I tried to prove through my research, and what I hope try to brought closer to you. Thank you.
Okay, we have time for some questions.
Yes.
Anybody like to?
Can I ask about the situation then with the outbreak of the war and how it affected all this overlapping?
Sorry, again?
The beginning of the war and the fall of
the 1914?
Mm-hmm.
The strange thing is, like, at this time, only I concentrated my focus was until 1908, until the Antwerp Revolution. But then I thought, but I want to take this in, so I have to check what happened to them. So that's why I can just give you information on Tripoli. I don't know what happened in Beirut. But I know in Tripoli, which was also more concerned by the war because the Ottoman government destroyed the new built railway that could also lead to the mountains. And the Ottomans didn't trust the people living in the mountains because they were minorities. And they thought, well, maybe they fight then against us, with the Europeans against us. So first they destroyed the railway, which was really bad for Tripoli because it was almost all straight. The port was not really big at this time. And then they had all, like in whole Syria, I knew it, but I didn't take that into consideration that much, but there was really starvation. There were diseases, there were cholera, people were poor, people died of hunger. And I found in the book of El Saab, although it was founded in 1914, it meets all the year through. Like 1914, there are regular meetings, although without foreigners still. And then there's a break, really break, 4 years. And then Mina Al-Amin is established, 1918. No, I don't know where they met, because by now everyone says it's not existent anymore, but it's not. At least for some time, they existed all three together, because the letters of Ashi, who got letters from all three of them, so that they must have been somewhere. But at least NSAP just has a break until the beginning of 1919, although some found 1918 Mina Al-Amin. And I don't think in Beirut it was much different. It was just too, their physical needs were too overwhelming as that they could still meet. Probably the charity went on, I'm pretty sure it went on. And the missionaries tried probably also to help. But meetings, Masonic meetings, but for scientific reasons, I don't know.
They were able to reestablish
themselves. Yeah, they did. Qadisha existed until 1930. And it's written in the proceedings of the Grand Lodge of Scotland that the lodge was closed, its charter withdrawn by the Grand Lodge of Scotland because of some irregularities at the 17th of October 1930. Until now, I don't know what happened. If someone knows what happened at this date in Tripoli, I'm more than interested. Yes.
How do you explain the numbers of the different affiliations to either the Grand Lodge of Scotland or the Grand Orient? Is there something in the origin of these lodges that explain why they're affiliated to them?
I think it was not because of the ritual, because no one in Scotland or France could ever prove what ritual they had. I mean, you have for you have this district governors or responsible persons, Europeans, for responsible for lodges built under the Grand Lodge of Scotland. And normally you get regular reports about their district they're responsible for, and they state about the situation of the lodges. And almost no years exist some reports of Greater Syria, so the communication was not the best. And I think, just as I said, Maronites may well be more attracted to French lodges because they thought that the Grand Orient can actually influence the politics, which they didn't.
Yeah.
Especially when they're really suffering under Abdulhamid, they sent letters. The correspondence still exists between the Grand Orient de France and Le Liban. So they sent letters and say, hey, what are you doing? Why don't you help us against this Abdulhamid? And trying to kind of, they call themselves Petit Français, and we want to be like the little France, and Liberté and Égal, it's like this, and it doesn't work. Because at this time, France doesn't want the Ottoman Empire to break. The same with England. They want it to exist. They think still that they can save it somehow against Russia, mainly, to have something against Russia. And they would never have done anything that harms the politics of their own country. I think it was just this affiliation or connotation or association, French, Maronites, Christian. That's good for us. Also, French Revolution. The French Revolution was still the revolution in general. I mean, I don't know. I didn't put in a letterhead. They all had the letterheads: Liberté, Égalité, Fraternité, or the English version, because they so much thought Freemasons were actually the ones who did the French Revolution, which is not true. But for them, it was true. So they built their own history on the believed history.
So does that imply that the lodges that were affiliated with the Grand Orient had a more critical political position in relation to the Sultan?
No, you do find that in Egypt, where you can really say, well, more politically involved, more revolutionary, say,
yeah.
Were for sure the French ones. But you can't find any political involvement which at the same time shows you or gives you a sign for any Masonic kind of unit or conspiracy or movement connected to France or Scotland. I thought that at the beginning, I hoped for it. I hoped for some political action, but they don't. I really think it's most social oriented.
Several times you mentioned intellectuals,
mm-hmm.
intellectual masons, and yet you also mentioned them alongside other categories, professional categories,
yeah,
who might have included intellectuals. So
right.
What's your definition of intellectual?
That's what I tried to define,
yeah,
before I started, because
yeah,
I read everywhere intellectual, and it's sometimes so over-inflated use of these words that is one reason why I didn't want to write about Beirut anymore.
Mm-hmm.
Because everyone says, yeah, the Arabic intellectual thoughts. And what is an intellectual? When is someone an intellectual and one not? So I tried to get to a definition and looked at what Mannheim said and looked at what Gramsci said and looked at Bourdieu. And then I thought, okay, I stop using this term intellectual, or use it only when I have some output, some written output in form of either, say, they're writing history, a book on philosophy, a book, they have a newspaper. But as then I divided between the full-time intellectuals, it's it's weak. It's a weak definition, but it's hard to get somehow to it, because I think the whole mentioning of the Arab intellectual during this Arab intellectual movement, which you had during the 19th century, is just too much emphasized. It wasn't like that. And it was not these great intellectuals. Most of them gained after their death, were successful after, gained the fortune after their death.
One says, I think you were giving an account of what membership numbers,
mm-hmm.
which includes sort of numbers of doctors and numbers of, was it 638 government employees,
yeah.
and so on, and then a certain number of intellectuals. So
right.
presumably there was a working definition lying behind that, because that
wasn't
your
term.
Yeah,
it was more the main profession, if it wasn't the only one, their main profession and for what their name stands for is an intellectual output.
Okay.
It could be that, Ibrahim Yazdi was translator. He was also the one that translated the Bible in Arabic, and he was also one who wrote poems and wrote one of the most famous one of this is Arab Awake against the by then Turkification. So he's known as intellectual. He's not known as working as translator.
I do. Just one question. About Lieutenant Burnaby. Who was he?
I don't know. I know he's from the occupation army of France, and he was there.
French.
From he was a British colonel, but working at the head of the occupation party army. He was there. He arrived. He took the charter and left. So it's written in the proceedings. This shouldn't happen more often. We have to stick our procedures to the regular procedures and rules and laws.
And I think your point about intellectuals is very interesting, really, because
it is.
They recently that chap who wrote The Black Swan, even Nicholas Taleb, talks about the reason Beirut, after 1,000 years, suddenly collapsed into this catastrophic war, as being the reason being a brain drain.
Mm-hmm.
That was what he thought caused it to.
But it's also when I said that the censorship gets worse and worse during Abdul Hamid's reign. Like, there's a nice example, I don't know if it's true, but it's at least it shows its paranoia. He, for a certain time, he took in all chemistry books, like said they're not allowed to be printed anymore, because he found the formula for water, H2O0. And he thought it stands for Abdul Hamid the Second is nothing worth. It's nothing good. It's worthwhile. And so he took in all the books, and this brain drain actually took place. So you have all the a lot of journalists, most of the by then famous intellectual journalists and masons, go to Egypt, and either they stay there or they come sometime back to Beirut, but a lot of them just stay there.
And I was referring to the 70s, of course, the analysis of the 70s.
To the 1970s.
Yes, a brain drain. Mm. Thank you.
Yeah.
Anything else anybody wants to ask or comment?
I just wanted to say one more thing. Some traveler went to a little village in the mountains called Sahla. It was in the 1930s, and even then, still 1/3 of the inhabitants of Sahle were able to speak Portuguese, because so many left for Brazil, and they had even a street called Rua Brasil, something like that, and sometimes sang the national anthem to honorate the Brazilians. And I think it's very interesting that it's not only the used. Go to America, make your fortune. They go to Brazil. I mean, who goes to Brazil? But they came. A lot of them came back, and that's why so many speak now. Still, 30s Portuguese.
Where does your work take you next? What's the next stage in your research? How much more material do you have to go?
I'm overloaded with material and pictures and founder names. And actually, I'm now at the main chapter, or from I think the most important chapter, which is Khadija, and then the beginnings of the beginnings, at least, and so
mm-hmm.
a away from Beirut. It's fascinating, but after a while it's just too, yeah, the intellectuals, it's just too much.
I've spent a lifetime in universities, I wouldn't know. Anyway, thank you very much for a splendid presentation, Dorothy. Refreshments are available outside?
Yes. Right. Yeah, that's too long.